Part 3. Nagnamor could only maintain his physical form for about 2 minutes with the near 1,000 MP the mimic supplied him with during the possession ritual. Once that was up, he would crumble into dust and disappear. That seemed to be the nature of how this particular ritual worked. The demon called forth from the beyond would have tremendous power, but his body would deteriorate rapidly after a short while. The other offering-type ritual the mimic knew about, this one addressed to a being named Liu Solra, would probably be the same. Unfortunately, it was quite a bit more involved, requiring more raw materials and multiple sacrifices to be made, so Boxy couldn't whip it out to see what it was all about. It was ultimately all the same, though. Even if it was temporary, having a high-ranking demon's servitude was simply a means to an end. Performing a ritual of that magnitude did wonders for its demonology proficiency, and it still had plenty of troll blood to go around. It had therefore repeated the offering to Nagnamor a total of 3 times after the first and was currently getting ready for another encore. Snack seemed eager to complain about her role in it, though. Even Arms was trying to get her master to stop for some reason. As for Punchy, he was understandably the most pissed off of all and complained the loudest. However, all of them were summarily told to shut their teeth holes and were ignored completely as the stubborn box continued to do whatever it wanted. But the one thing that could not be ignored so easily was that constant ringing noise inside the mimic's mind. It had been going on for the last hour or so, pretty much ever since the first time Punchy's physical body turned to dust. It obviously wasn't going to be silenced as easily as Boxy's familiars, the Overlord included. The main reason it was so grating, however, was because this was different from a simple sound. It was as if something was poking at the monster's mind directly in an effort to get its attention. Well, it didn't seem like the sound would just go away on its own, and even a creature of near-infinite patience could only take so much damned ringing. So it made the inevitable decision to address the problem directly. Luckily for the simple crate, the knowledge regarding what to do popped up into its mind the instant it stopped forcibly ignoring it. Yes? All it had to do was answer the call.
Freaking finally!
Came the gruff, raspy, and slightly annoyed voice from the beyond.
Hey, buddy. It's Carl from Demons R Us.
Hi, Carl. This was the first time Demons R Us had contacted the mimic directly. Admittedly, this was only the 4th time the mimic had spoken to the organization's representative, but that was beside the point.
What's this about? Boxy asked.
Yeah. So, listen, I'm calling about the whole Overlord Nagnamor thing you've been getting up to. We've received some troubling complaints, and I need to get your side of the story. Do you mind if I ask you a few questions?
I'm busy.
I won't stop ringing until you answer me, by the way.
All right, I'm listening.
Okay, so, how exactly did you summon the Overlord into the physical realm?
I did the ritual.
Which one?
With the squiggles and the chanting and the stabbing.
You're going to have to be more specific.
Pretty much all demonic rituals involved at least one of those things. A lot of the time, it was all 3 at once.
It was the offering thingy.
Then it was the offering to Nagnamor after all, huh?
Yes, that.
And how did you fulfill the pure maiden stabbed in the heart part of the ceremony?
I told Snack to do it.
I'm sorry? Snack?
Yes.
Who's that?
My familiar.
Which one?
The one with the hair and the legs.
Carl took a deep breath before he continued. It was a matter of professional pride that he didn't allow himself to scream at the deranged toddler.
The blue or red one?
He asked after reconsidering his approach.
Blue.
Okay, and how do you suppose a succubus qualifies as a pure maiden?
She's a female that wasn't poisoned or diseased. She was also clean. Before the blood, at least.
Oh, wow. Okay, it's starting to make sense now.
The thing about magic was that it relied heavily on the mind. Spells had a precise formula to them, so different people would get very similar results when casting the same one. The only real difference in that situation would be the magnitude of the magic invoked, barring the effects of skills like crystallized magic. Rituals and such, however, were more free-form and could be easily influenced by one's perception and preconceptions. To put it another way, if the mimic who didn't know any better sincerely believed that Zira was pure, then she would be pure. At least for the sake of completing the ritual.
Leave it to those fucking idiots to leave in a loophole like that,
Carl mumbled under his breath.
Hmm? Oh, don't mind that. What about the heart part?
Made snack grow one.
Wait, what? But succubi shouldn't be able to change their insides to that degree.
Yeah. Had to show her how to make one from her skin. Because she's stupid.
Wait. You ordered your familiar to grow a heart on the outside of her body?
Yes.
Holy shit. I never would have even thought of that. That's actually kind of impressive in its own way. Okay, and what was your purpose in summoning Nagnamor?
I wanted skill proficiency for demonology.
What? Just that?
Yes.
No kingdoms you wanted toppled, or ancient beings of terrible power to suppress?
Nope.
I see. Hold, please.
An odd sound started playing inside the mimic's head. It wasn't like anything the monster had ever heard before, but it was actually quite pleasant. Ah, this must be that music thing it vaguely knew about. Who knew sound could be so tasty? It sat there enjoying the tune for several minutes before Carl came back on the line.
I apologize for that. Would you forward me your status, please?
Okay. Sending.
I see you got a name. Buxy T. Morningwood? Pfft. Hold, please!
Well, this was unlike Carl. Usually the demon was quick and to the point about demon-related business. It wasn't like Boxy had anywhere to go, though. It was currently gathering up mana for the next ritual, and the music was tasty anyway, so it didn't particularly mind waiting.
Again, sorry about that, Mr. Morning... Morningwood?
Just Boxy's fine.
The animate chest didn't mind being called Mr. Morningwood, but Carl seemed unable to say it with a straight face for some reason. This irked the monster somewhat. If he wasn't going to say the name properly, then he shouldn't be saying it at all.
Right then. See here, Boxy. I'm gonna be straight with you. You can't summon Overlord Nagnamor using your demon as collateral.
Why not?
It violates part of the summoning contract. The one where you promise to safeguard your familiar's immortal soul against harm.
Come to think of it, Zira was talking about her ego being consumed by Nagnamor's terrible will or something like that. Boxy didn't see how that was an issue, so it just kept doing what it wanted as usual.
I know you probably don't understand,
Carl added.
So I'll clarify. Cramming two demons into the same physical vessel like that? Worst case scenario, both of them could get fragmented or malformed. That wasn't what you were trying to do, right?
No.
Good. 'Cause that'd be bad.
How bad?
We'd have to kill you.
That's bad.
Indeed.
I understand. I'll stop using snack to summon Punchy.
Punchy?
Yeah. The big one with the head and the arms. He punches himself real good, said Boxy with a hint of admiration.
huh. So, listen, there's one more thing I need to talk to you about. I don't know what you made the Overlord do over there, and I have no intention of prying, but he's threatening to quit being an officer in the Demon King's army if he so much as smells you again. I doubt he'd actually do it, but we here at Demons R Us want to make extra sure that doesn't happen. That's why we're prepared to offer you a deal.
A deal?
That's right! You have to agree that you'll never perform the offering to Nagnamore ever again, regardless of who or what your sacrifice is. In return, we'll provide you with a one-time boost of demonology proficiency up to level 5.
Okay, I accept.
All right. Hold, please.
Of course it agreed. Increasing demonology levels was the reason Boxy was doing this whole thing in the first place. So getting what it wanted with less work was not a bad thing. It was downright tasty, as a matter of fact. Besides, it took a whole lot of time and preparation to summon Punchy, and it only lasted a few minutes. Even if the performance was excellent, his mileage was pretty bad.
There. All set. I've added our agreement to your summoning contract. You should be getting your compensation shortly.
Proficiency level increased. Demonology is now level 5. Wisdom plus 4. Mental fortitude plus 4.
I got it.
Good. That's great. Phew. Hey, thanks for agreeing to that. I gotta say, it's so much easier working with you than my regular clients.
Really?
Yeah. You're uncomplicated and straightforward. It's a breath of fresh air compared to those edgy idiots I have to work with usually. Always with the stupid comments like, "You shall not pass," and "You have no power here." It's like those dumbasses didn't even properly read the summoning contract.
Carl spent a few more minutes complaining about other warlocks. Boxy didn't really mind, since it was fairly interesting listening to him.
And then he went and did it anyway. Can you believe that?
I guess.
Look, what I'm trying to say is, it's honestly refreshing to work with someone like you. This whole thing would have been a laugh if it wasn't for the actual Demon King breathing down my neck. Anyway, sorry for that little rant. I've been under a lot of pressure lately.
It's all right.
Carl let out another tired sigh before he moved on to wrapping up his service call.
So, just so we're clear, do not ever use that ritual again. Okay?
Okay.
And don't use your familiars as sacrifices ever again, either. That's the important thing here. We wouldn't give a flying fuck if your rectangular ass died out there, but if a demon bites the big one because of your antics, then even killing you 100,000 times wouldn't be enough payback. Understood?
It was important to keep in mind that the summoning contract was indeed a partnership and not outright slavery. Generally speaking, what happened to a demon's physical form didn't matter to an immortal being in the grand scheme of things, but endangering the integrity of their soul was another story. It was the one thing that must never, under any circumstances, be tampered with. If that clause was violated, then their contractor getting killed would just be the beginning of his or her punishment. What followed next would be... well, suffice it to say, oblivion would be a much more preferable option.
You're lucky we caught this thing early,
Carl said.
Another 10 or so more rituals and the soul of Zirababadabuthloak Relayla would have suffered irreversible damage, and you'd have been on your way to eternal torment.
Carl, is my contract in danger?
Nah, you're fine. It's not like you were doing it on purpose. Besides, you cooperated readily, and both of your familiars testified as to your, character. Therefore, the higher-ups have agreed to let you off with just a stern warning.
So it seemed that Demons R Us was going to take Boxy's actions as a simple misunderstanding rather than malicious intent.
I see. Thanks, Carl.
Sure. Just try and avoid pissing off my boss anymore, yeah? Or else he might seriously terminate you.
How do I do that?
That's actually pretty easy. You just keep doing what you do, only without the two things we talked about just now. Like, for real, don't. And don't take so long to answer if we're the ones calling you, okay?
Okay.
Good, good. Okay, bye.
Well, that conversation was educational. Boxy nearly stepped on quite the landmine there due to its own ignorance. But things had more or less worked out for the best.
All right, Snack. You can get down from there. Arms, untie her.
Oh, thank fuck,
said Zira.
I really don't know how much longer I could take sharing a body with that insufferable asshole.
Hey, come on,
Cora complained as she untied the succubus from the stake.
Uncle Nagi isn't that bad.
Yes, he is. The whole reason he wanted a pure maiden is because... Wait, uncle? He's your kin?
Yeah, he's the eldest of my dad's 49 siblings. I only met him once or twice, though.
Wow, that kind of makes things a lot worse.
What do you mean?
The first thought he had when he saw you was how he'd like to, and I'm quoting his head here, split that fine ass on his dick.
Oh, that's high praise coming from an archfiend.
It is.
Of course. Oi, don't give me that disgusted look. If a fiend says they want to stick it up your butt, it means they think highly of you.
Wow,
the succubus exclaimed, shaking her head.
I always suspected your kind were idiots, but that's just ridiculous. What sort of twisted logic considers anal rape a sign of affection?
Who knows?
Answered Cora with a shrug.
Probably the same kind that actively craves it like you do.
Yeah, okay. You got me there. Wait a minute. Is that why you've done me exclusively in the rear these past few days?
What can I say? I've grown to like... No, that's not quite right. I tolerate you more than I thought I would. Even if you're a succubus, you're incredibly slutty and your insides feel fantastic. Can't help but grow attached to a girl like that. Shut up!
Zira blurted, slightly flustered.
Keep those disturbing thoughts to yourself, you fucking asshole.
Thanks for the compliment, sugar tits!
We're leaving now, said Boxy, putting an end to their little exchange. There are things I need to get.
Even if they had leftover troll blood, that one ritual was all the mimic was really equipped to do. They'd have to find components, and sacrifices, to enact some of the other ones. Of particular interest was a ceremony that was meant to call forth unholy wealth, whatever that was. The knowledge about this shiny-sounding thing had flowed into Boxy's mind when its demonology rose in levels, so it was still parsing the relevant information. The mimic would need quite a few things to pull that one off, not to mention it lacked knowledge about the warlock job in general. The time for playing around in the wilderness was over. The need to take up residence inside a city was now top priority. Chapter 3 Gainful Employment Part 1 The city of Arosa, which was part of the Lodrak Empire, stood on the banks of a river known as the Whispering Canal. Named after its calm waters and predictable currents, this body of water flowed in from the Sawblade Mountains to the north and kept going in a relatively straight line until it flowed out into the ocean. Its sprawling delta, some 5 kilometers south of the city, had formed the massive Whispering Marshes that spanned an area of roughly 500 square kilometers. To the west of Arosa lay the Troll Woods, named for the dominant species of monster that lived in those parts. The depths of this sprawling forest were wild and largely untamed, but it was still a valuable source of high-quality timber and magical ingredients. The numerous small villages that dotted its outskirts dedicated their time to lumbering, gathering, farming, and tending to the fertile soil. However, they had to constantly be on guard against monster attacks and bandit raids, which is why most of them had small, localized militias. The city itself was in the southwestern corner of the empire. Going beyond the Whispering Marshes or through the Troll Woods to the west would lead one to the shores of the Shimmering Ocean, at the edge of the continent. The relatively nearby Sawblade Mountains ran northwest by southeast through the middle of the empire's territory, all the way to the western edge of the mainland. With the mountains to the north and northeast and the Shimmering Ocean to the south and west, this province was known as Cradle Valley. The only easily accessible land route in and out of this territory was to the east of the city of Arosa along the Imperial Highway. This wide cobblestone road continued north out of the city and ran between the Whispering Canal to the east and Troll Woods to the west. Following this road north for about a week would lead travelers to the city of Monotol. This Cradle Valley was one of the weakest and poorest areas of the Empire. Being mostly isolated from the heartland meant that traders, merchants, and travelers barely went through these parts. Although the city of Erosa was actually flourishing, this was mostly due to its geographical position near the entrance to the valley. This was a far cry from the rest of the province, which was sparsely populated with only 2 cities, 6 towns, and 30-odd villages. The total population of the region was a mere 55,000, just barely more than the imperial capital of Oshinus. Or at least that was what it should have been about 2 weeks ago. The calamity of Monotol that killed over 8,000 of the Empire's citizens was one thing, but the aftershocks of the event were still underway. Rumors spread of a foul green mist that spread outwards from the former city, a thick miasma that poisoned the very ground and air. The subsequent investigation by the Emperor's spymaster had revealed the depth and breadth of this calamity to the crown, and the young Emperor had passed a decree that the government would spearhead an effort to contain and repair the damage to the land. The Empire's response to this catastrophe would have been far slower if it wasn't for Bernard Samson, the hero of the hammer and Teresa's chosen. Having lost his life in the calamity, he revived at the Temple of Teresa in the capital the very same day, allowing him to relay the dire news of this disaster before the proverbial dust had settled. The investigation in question was also expedited thanks to the half-lion, half-eagle creatures known as griffins. Riding the house-sized winged beasts allowed the spymaster's team to pass over the inhospitable and treacherous Sawblade Mountains. Not having to go around them or risk scaling them the hard way allowed the dispatched officials to arrive at their destination in a matter of days rather than weeks. Unfortunately, the actual relief effort would have to take the long way around. Although mighty, swift, and of noble bearing, griffins were high maintenance and relatively few in number. Using them to properly address the situation was not economically feasible due to the sheer amount of manpower and materials that needed to be transported. Just organizing the relief effort and compiling the necessary resources would take weeks, possibly even months. There was no guarantee the Empire would be able to salvage the area, nor was there any way to tell how long it would take, even if they could. In other words, the Crown was unable to properly reassure the populace, causing unrest and fear to spread like wildfire throughout Cradle Valley. "What if the wind spread that poisonous miasma around?" said some. "What if some strange new illness appeared because of this?" questioned others. "That place is cursed. The undead will rise in great numbers and spread throughout the land," was a popular but misinformed opinion. As a result, over 5,000 people had already migrated out of the province. The region's total population of 55,000 had already fallen to just under 42,000 and was expected to get much lower. It was already at a stage where the lords and nobles had serious doubts the region would ever truly recover. There were, however, those who profited immensely from this, namely adventurers in the 40 to 60 level range. The city of Erosa, that normally held about 10,000 residents at any given time, had suddenly found itself bloated with hundreds upon hundreds of adventurers who came to profit off the event. After all, it wasn't just the people that were looking to abandon this valley. All manner of monsters and wild animals had also begun pushing south and east, away from the calamity's epicenter. Bandits were also becoming an increasingly bigger problem, as hapless villagers who were either unable or unwilling to hire protection made for easy targets. Under such circumstances, it was really no surprise that adventurers found themselves privy to an unnaturally large volume of quests involving monster subjugation or working as armed escorts. And of course, overseeing all of this were all the various guilds that each individual belonged to. These privately owned organizations had the task of making sure all of their clients' requests were met in a timely manner and at competitive prices, while also keeping their members supplied with both equipment and information. They all stood to make solid profits with so much work going around, but the one that made the most money off other people's suffering was, as usual, the Mercenary Guild. Their office was a wooden 2-story building on a busy road near the northern gate of Erosa. This organization had the rather unorthodox policy of running a bar and restaurant at all of its offices and often doubled as an inn. While other guilds also offered goods and services to their members, they focused on seemingly less frivolous things, like selling potions, crafting materials, weapons, armor, and reference materials. However, this guild knew its members well. The stereotypical mercenary was a drifter, someone constantly on the road and with no roots of their own. Having a safe place where they could enjoy a warm meal, a cold drink, and a clean, soft bed was more than enough. And while they could get those things elsewhere, it was often accompanied by distrusting looks or busybodies poking their noses where they didn't belong. Such things didn't happen at the Mercenary Guild. The rooms they offered all had state-of-the-art locks and anti-eavesdropping wards, but most important of all, nobody asked any personal questions unless absolutely necessary. This don't-ask-don't-tell attitude was also why the restaurant on the ground floor was so quiet right now, despite there being over 30 people in it. While some of them were exchanging information and a few others were recruiting temporary teammates, the vast majority of them ate their breakfast and minded their own goddamned business. The most that could be heard was a soft murmur and the clanking of spoons and forks. The wooden front door swung open slowly, and an enormous figure, well over 2 meters tall, walked into the building. He wore a heavy black cloak that obscured most of his body, and his face and hair were wrapped up in a dark blue cloth to make a makeshift mask that left only the area around his eyes exposed. What little could be seen of the skin on his face was pale, and his irises were a piercing yellow color that seemed to notice every little detail around him. The feet that poked out under the hem of his cloak were a pair of sturdy-looking brown leather boots that were a size or two larger than your typical adventurer, much like the rest of him. Just looking at his tall figure and wide shoulders made it obvious his body was well-built. It was a physique well-suited to close combat jobs that relied on muscle power and stamina, such as a warrior, berserker, or paladin. Well, his presence in this guild made it clear that last one wasn't the case. Paladins were way too self-righteous to be caught dead in a place like this, and they knew nothing about subtlety. A far cry from this stranger. He moved along the wooden floorboards without making any of the heavy footsteps one would expect from a man of his stature. He also carried himself with a sort of grace that made it clear he wasn't just some brawler. Indeed, his odd demeanor had allowed the more observant mercenaries gathered here to deduce he was of an agility-based job, like a ranger or rogue. Perhaps even one of His Majesty's spies. The fact he was doing it seemingly unconsciously was a telltale sign that his job level was beyond 25, meaning he wasn't a rookie either. It was also possible he had broken past level 50, which would put him on equal footing with the other veteran mercenaries around. The people in the guild all stared at the newcomer as he walked across the restaurant towards the bar at the far end of the hall.
"What? It's just him again?" said one of them dismissively under his breath.
The elf that had spoken up stopped gawking and resumed minding his own goddamned business. His breakfast, which consisted of a cup of tea, 2 grilled sausages, and a bowl of suspiciously chunky gruel, was far more important than some foreboding dark figure. Most of the others had much the same reaction and went about their morning routine. People like this stranger were surprisingly common among mercenaries, after all. Granted, the guy's size made him stand out more than usual, but this was hardly his first visit to this place. A few of the more observant regulars noticed he always seemed to come in during breakfast or dinner, yet never actually ordered any food. They could hardly blame him, though, as the cheap meals on offer could hardly be called tasty. The wrinkled old dwarf attending the bar wore a long-sleeved off-white tunic and slightly baggy dark gray pants, ending in a pair of town shoes that were beige in color. He had a thick brown beard with streaks of silver in it, and his head was almost completely bald. The barman slash receptionist put away the glass he was pretending to clean and turned his attention to the newcomer.
"Ah, welcome back, Master Morningwood,"
he said in a strictly professional manner. Several people who overheard him giggled or snorted as they failed to suppress their laughter, but he ignored them.
"I take it your quest is complete?"
The tall figure opposite him nodded as it sat down on one of the bar stools, though he still loomed over the standing dwarf. The bartender ducked under the counter momentarily and came back up holding an aquamarine-colored crystal ball, about the size of a child's head. It was set into a circular wooden base like a plaque or pedestal, though its function was to keep the thing from rolling around the place rather than show it off. He placed it on the counter, right in front of the other, much taller gentleman.
"Please, go ahead," said the dwarf.
Mr. Morningwood nodded again and stretched out a hand from under his cloak. It was fittingly large and bandaged in such a way as to cover his palm and the back of his hand, leaving his thick, pale fingers free to move about as they pleased. He placed his palm on top of the crystal like he was trying to grip it.
"Confirm quest,"
he chanted with a deep, clear voice, and the ball flashed a few times in response. "Boxy T. Morningwood has completed a quest. Slay 10 Murk Dwellers." Both men at the bar saw the same notification in their heads.
"Confirm quest,"
repeated the man without taking his hand off the crystal. "Boxy T. Morningwood has completed a quest. Slay 5 ogres."
"Confirm quest."
"Boxy T. Morningwood has completed a quest. Deliver the steel ingots."
"Confirm quest."
"Boxy T. Morningwood has completed a quest. Night watch."
"Very good, Master Morningwood. I believe that's everything,"
said the aged dwarf behind the bar.
"I will prepare your compensation immediately,"
he added, then disappeared into a back room. The receptionist would probably be a little while, so Boxy decided to make use of its time and walked over to the quest board. It was a large wooden notice board that took up most of the wall to the right of the bar and had a large number of parchments stuck to it. Boxy gave it a once-over, looking for any suitable work an enterprising young mimic could do in a day or two. One would think this act would be an impossible thing for an illiterate monster like itself. But that wasn't really the case. It wasn't all that uncommon to find adventurers who could not read, especially among the type of ruffians and thugs that frequented the mercenary guild, which was why the notices posted on its quest board were made with such individuals in mind. Quest postings always bore a small stamp that denoted the type of objective. Monster subjugations and hunts were marked by a pair of red-crossed swords. Escorts were a blue shield. Collection and gathering tasks had a green basket, and so on and so forth. The difficulty of each quest was marked with an equally easy-to-understand star rating, and every mercenary worth their salt knew at least how to read numbers and do basic arithmetic. Otherwise, they ran the risk of being scammed whenever money changed hands around them. Unfortunately for Boxy, it failed to spot anything tasty-looking. Killing other monsters, standing guard at the city gate, or ferrying goods were the types of quests it preferred since they were simple, straightforward, and required minimal conversation. However, none of those types of commissions were available. Most of the notices left on the board were related to escorting people, collecting ingredients, or other odd jobs. Being an escort was out of the question. Boxy had a tough enough time acting human without having to also babysit a number of them over a period of several days. It was more than that, though. The thought of escorting people and protecting them was, simply put, ridiculous. That was literally like asking a starving wolf to shepherd a group of lambs. Odd jobs were also out. Those also appeared to involve a level of personal interaction that the mimic was not willing to undertake. Moreover, the ratio of time taken to gold earned was bad. In the end, the monster-cum-mercenary reached out and grabbed a parchment detailing a collection quest. Boxy peeled the notice off the board with little resistance and placed it on the bar counter. The receptionist returned a minute later with 8 small pouches in his hands.
"Here are your deposits," he said, setting 4 of them side by side. "And these 4 are your rewards. Would you like to confirm the amount?"
Boxy nodded and reached out to feel the weight on each of them. The unmistakable clack of gold they made when shaken was like music to its fake ears. The monster in disguise used its magical perception to peek inside the pouches and make extra sure that the agreed-upon amount was all there. The mimic nodded its dummy head at the old dwarf and put away 7 of the pouches under its heavy cloak. The last one, however, it placed on top of the parchment it took from the quest board earlier.
"Ah, another one!"
exclaimed the bartender. He picked up the pouch and looked over the notice, then nodded.
"As you wish, Mr. Morningwood."
He set the parchment back down on the bar and placed the crystal ball from before on top like it was a glorified paperweight. This was a magic tool known as a quest logger, which could be used to relay the contents of the parchments directly into the customer's mind, regardless of their ability to read letters or words. The whole process of picking out and undertaking a new quest was so streamlined and simplistic that even literate mercenaries sometimes skipped reading long-winded requests for themselves and brought them straight to the counter. Boxy wasn't among their number, though, so it honestly had no idea what this gathering request was actually about. Eager to find out, it placed a hand on top of the quest logger once again. The crystal ball glowed slightly and fed a stream of information into the mimic's mind. Collect 120 kilograms of bouncewood bark. Description: deliver 120 kilograms of bouncewood bark to the mercenary guild in the city of Erosa. Bouncewood trees may be found in the Troll Woods west of Erosa and are easily recognizable due to their smooth and black surface. Difficulty: 2 stars. Time limit: 4 days. Deposit: 100 GP. Reward: 100 GP. Progress: 0 out of 120. Well, it certainly seemed simple enough. The pay wasn't all that great, and there was no killing involved, but at least it didn't involve any human interaction. The 4-day time limit was extremely generous, and the task itself would be quite easy if the difficulty rating was any indication. 2 stars meant that an individual's primary job had to be level 25 to safely complete a quest. 3 stars would raise that bar to level 50, and 4 to level 75. 1 star, on the other hand, would mean any civilian could perform the task and was only used for mundane chores like cleaning or cooking. It was worth keeping in mind that this rating signified the recommended power level an individual needed to safely complete a task. It was only a rough assessment meant to be taken as a guideline, as it was literally impossible for such a metric to be completely accurate all the time. Job, skill, and gear compositions varied widely, not only from one person to the next, but also between adventuring parties. For instance, it was entirely possible that a group of adventurers with an average level of 30 could flawlessly complete a 3-star quest. Even a 4-star one wasn't out of reach if they had excellent teamwork, equipment, and were prepared to suffer casualties. A 5-star one was, however, nothing short of a suicide mission for that theoretical team. Whether they would be allowed to leave on that expedition depended entirely on the internal policies of the guild they belonged to. As far as the Mercenary Guild was concerned, they allowed pretty much anyone to accept quests from their board. No questions asked. However, such freedom came at a price in the shape of a mandatory deposit. It was a requirement unique to the Mercenary Guild wherein individuals would have to leave behind a certain amount of gold for every quest they undertook, to serve as collateral. If the mercenary accomplished their task to a satisfying degree, they would get their deposit back in full in addition to the quest's completion reward. Should they fail or disappear, never to be heard from again, then the guild would repost the quest and keep their deposit for themselves. That way the guild either had a satisfied customer in the face of the one who posted the quest, or they had a lump sum of gold with which to settle any damages or grievances that resulted from the failure of the quest. Even if the quest was technically complete, they also had the authority to withhold part of the deposit should the client have viable complaints. Bottom line was that the Mercenary Guild would make a profit no matter what happened in the field. There were, of course, a significant number of high-profile quests that were not made available to outsiders. Non-members also did not have the backing of the guild should things go awry with the client or the authorities. But such trifling matters were of little concern to Boxy. The mimic could get paid without having to subject itself to an appraisal examination, and that was all that mattered.
"Accept quest," it chanted.
Both the crystal and the parchment glowed with a soft yellow light for several seconds. The tracking-type magic then enveloped Boxy and a message appeared for both it and the receptionist. "Boxy T. Morningwood has undertaken a quest. Collect 120 kilograms of bouncewood bark."
"Will that be all?"
asked the wrinkled old dwarf as he put away the crystal and the parchment behind the counter.
"No,"
answered Boxy.
"Selling."
Its arm reached out from under its cloak once more and placed something before the receptionist that looked like a rose flower made out of steel razors and wires. The dwarf picked it up carefully, making sure not to cut his fingers on the numerous sharp edges that jutted out from it.
"Identify."
"Blade Blossom." A disposable weapon made by a rookie artificer. Pulling on the wire at the base of the blade blossom will trigger its mechanism, which launches a high number of spring-loaded blades in all directions. This particular item is of superior construction, allowing it to inflict exceptional damage despite being made out of common materials. Estimated value? 24 GP. Boxy had placed 3 more of the things on the counter by the time the receptionist was finished appraising the first one. The dwarf quickly verified those as well, and then made an offer.
All right. I'll buy all of them for 70 GP.
The man-shaped monster on the other side of the counter simply nodded in response, as it did not possess the knowledge or people skills necessary to haggle. The dwarf then quickly produced the money and handed it over to complete the transaction. With its business concluded for the moment, the mimic briskly walked out of the building without saying another word. One of the human men, who had been silently staring at the cloaked figure since it walked in, went over to the bar and took a seat on the stool.
Hey, Grog, who was that?
He asked, a hint of worry in his voice.
Mr. Morningwood, came the casual answer. He showed up about a week ago and has been working hard ever since.
What do you think his deal is?
Don't know. Don't care. Though I do kind of like the guy, to be honest.
What?
Really? Sure. He's quiet, efficient, and doesn't try to haggle with me like the rest of you morons. He's basically the ideal mercenary in my book.
Oh, right. Yeah, you have a point. I don't like him one bit, though.
Ha! What's the matter, Torell? Jealousy's been scooping up all the work?
The dwarf asked with a small chuckle.
No? Well, a little. But that's not what I'm talking about. Something about him just don't feel right.
Okay, granted, the fella is a bit creepy, but—
No, Grog. Not creepy. Terrifying. My hair stands on end whenever I'm in the same room with that guy.
Yeah, I've been thinking the same thing,
said his ginger-haired companion, sitting on the bar stool next to Torell.
There's a thick stench of death about him. Just looking his way makes some small part of me want to run for my life. Ah, you two are just imagining things. I mean, sure, he's got that mysterious and intense atmosphere about him, but he's no worse than most of the other part-timers I've seen. Besides, has he ever shown even the slightest sign of hostility?
No, I guess not, Torell admitted.
Well, maybe he hasn't shown any hostility, but I definitely fucking felt it,
claimed the other human.
Ha! Look at you, Grog mocked. You're actually scared of the big guy in the heavy cloak. You're way too green if you let superficial stuff like that get to you.
But what if he's actually a criminal? Some mass murderer or psychopath?
Torell said. The dwarf shrugged his shoulders in response.
Ain't none of my business. Ain't none of the Mercenary Guild's business. And unless he does something to you, it ain't none of yours either.
Well, what if he has a huge bounty on his head?
The dwarf stopped organizing his bar and sighed.
Then it would be some bounty hunter's business. Look, lad, I like you, so let me offer you some advice on the house. Do not mess with that part-timer.
Torell briefly considered the elderly bartender's words. The dwarf was right, of course. There was no legal profit to be made from poking one's nose into some suspicious individual's private matters. Yet some part of him didn't let him put this matter out of his mind.
And just so we're clear, added the bartender, neither me nor my bosses are gonna be responsible if someone finds you dead in an alley. All right.
Yeah, okay. You've made your point. I'll stay out of his way.
The bartender's last few words struck a nerve with Torell. Not because he was afraid that scenario would happen. Just the opposite, actually. His intuition told him they wouldn't find him at all should he make an enemy of this Mr. Morningwood. Part 2. Boxy walked through the streets of Erosa with purpose. The new quest it picked up required a visit to the dense forest that was visible on the horizon beyond the city's walls. But that could wait. It had more pressing matters to attend to. As it continued along the relatively crowded streets, however, it yet again noticed an oddity that was pretty much a pattern by that point. Humans were shying away from it, giving its tall, cloaked figure a wide berth. At first it thought that was just the natural reaction to meeting a towering, dark, and masked stranger, but was growing convinced that wasn't the case, mostly because it was only the humans that reacted this way. Dwarves, elves, and even the rare beastkin or lizard man all showed much more subdued reactions. They also got out of its way while it walked around town, but that was mostly to avoid bumping into it. The humans practically leapt out of its way with looks of anxiety or even outright fear on their faces. Some even went so far as to let out a yelp and run away whenever they realized the towering stranger had snuck up on them. It wasn't just pedestrians, either. Human merchants also seemed unwilling to do business with it, and a few outright denied service. And while non-human businesses treated it with a certain amount of suspicion, that was immediately dispelled when the gold was brought out. Boxy had no idea why any of this was happening, but it didn't like it one bit. Many of its victims had made the same sort of expressions and reactions, so having others act this way when it was supposed to be hiding its true identity was quite untasty. As a mimic, Boxy's instincts told it to hide in plain sight and wait for its prey to draw close before it struck. Walking around in the open with so many pairs of eyes following its clearly conspicuous form was the exact opposite of that, making it a nerve-wracking experience. Having its cover blown and being targeted by more guards and adventurers than the monster could count was something Boxy wanted to avoid at all costs. However, there was no other way it could accomplish all the things it wanted to do, so it accepted these public appearances as a necessary risk. Thankfully, it reached its next destination without much incident. It stood in front of a small two-story building on the busy Market Street. The sign above the solid wooden door read, "Fizzy's Fidgety Widgets." There was a large glass window to the left of said door that was too dirty for anything but traces of sunlight to pass through. Boxy pushed the door open with a pale hand and went inside. The interior of the shop was not too different from the general store Boxy had visited several times before. Immediately to the right of the entrance was a mostly bare beige wall that had little going for it other than a random picture of what looked like an orange tabby cat. There was a wooden L-shaped counter to its front and left, with several shelves filled with various contraptions and mechanical gizmos behind it. The window was worthless as a light source, though that wasn't a problem due to the bright lamp hanging from the ceiling. A half-open door was visible in the far left corner from where the mimic was standing, allowing weird grinding and whirring noises to spill in from the workshop beyond it. Boxy closed the front door behind it, causing the doorframe to ring the little bell overhead for the second time. It immediately felt a pang of relief wash over it. Being indoors was a lot more comfortable than having to deal with the hundreds of prying eyes outside. It didn't feel quite right being inside a building, though, so it was perhaps more accurate to say that its new environment was simply less uncomfortable.
"Just a minute,"
came a slightly squeaky voice from farther inside the shop. The door in the corner opened up all the way, and a creature about the height and build of a 9-year-old human girl walked out from within. She had a cute face with pink hair tied in twin pigtails. A pair of huge, leather-bound safety goggles covered her large green eyes. Black splotches of oil stained her brown overalls, gray work shirt, and heavy leather gloves. In her right hand, she clutched a well-used steel wrench covered with scratches. This was Corny Fizzlesprocket, an artificer and current owner of Fizzy's Fidgety Widgets. Though she looked like a child, she was already a woman in her early 20s. Her small stature and somewhat awkward proportions were due to the fact that she was a gnome. Though her people were nowhere near as strong as humans due to the difference in height and mass, they more than made up for it in quick wits, sharp eyes, and nimble fingers.
"Oh, if it isn't Boxy,"
she exclaimed as she lifted the goggles from her eyes. The mimic returned the greeting with a nod, which seemed to be a satisfactory response.
"All right, give me a sec to clean up,"
she added while she disappeared beyond the back door. As for the monster in her midst, it was still somewhat amazed by how easy it was to get by just by nodding and gesturing. It wasn't like it couldn't speak, but it really needed to work on its communication skills when it came to talking with actual people. The last time it tried to hold an actual conversation, it almost got arrested for asking a street vendor if she was tasty. It had no idea what this sexual harassment thing she kept yelling about was, but it was made abundantly clear it needed to avoid speaking as much as possible. Fizzy returned from the back after a minute. She had changed out of her filthy clothes and now wore an off-white tank top, brown work pants, and a fresh pair of gloves. She had also made an attempt at wiping her face, but there was still a small black smudge on her cheek. She walked up to the counter and climbed on top of a small crate so that her entire upper body was visible above it. Her customer, on the other hand, sat cross-legged on the floor in front of her, putting the two of them on relatively equal eye level.
So, what can I do for you, big guy?
Asked the peppy gnome.
Need more lessons and materials, came the curt reply.
What? Already? Are you sure you properly practiced what I taught you last time?
The mimic nodded and reached into its cloak, taking out a blade blossom identical to the ones it sold earlier and placing it on the countertop. Fizzy reached over and carefully picked it up as she pulled a small screwdriver out of her tool belt. She then began inspecting Boxy's handiwork.
Not bad,
she commented, rolling the device around in her fingers and poking at it with her screwdriver.
Triggering mechanism is put together well. Springs are coiled properly. And the blades won't clash into each other when activated.
She kept commenting on the device's construction while taking it apart with practiced ease. Once she was done, she gingerly set the partially disassembled blade blossom down on the counter and put away her screwdriver.
You did a great job on the overall assembly,
was her verdict.
Frankly, it's kind of amazing you can do detailed work like this with those sausage-like fingers of yours. No offense.
The mimic waved its hand dismissively, which the gnome took to understand as, don't mind the small stuff.
Size aside, though, you have some serious talent for this stuff,
she continued.
I only taught you how to make these 3 days ago, and you're already this good. You should be past level 2 of the job by now, right?
Boxy nodded in response. The two then sort of stared at each other in silence for several seconds, before Fizzy remembered how bad of a conversationalist her latest student was.
So, what level is your artificer job now?
It was odd that she had to specifically ask all these rather obvious questions, but that wasn't necessarily a bad thing. Doing exactly what one was told was vital for a rookie artificer. Getting unnecessarily creative or omitting certain steps was how accidents happened in the workshop.
4.
The gnome blinked her huge eyes a few times, then smiled up at her student.
Hmm? I'm sorry. I think I misheard that. Could you repeat yourself?
Job is level 4.
Holy... 4? But you only started a week ago.
The cloaked figure tilted its masked head to show it didn't quite understand.
So?
So? So? It takes most people a month of practice to get their basics up to that level. Just how many... Wait, didn't you say something about materials? Did you already use up all the parts you bought last time?
She got another nod in response.
But there were enough bits in that toolbox you bought to make 100 of these.
Making so many and in such a short amount of time was a significant feat. But it wasn't just about the apparent speed of the assembly. If Fizzy's newest pupil really did progress that quickly, then almost all of those spring-loaded traps were as well-built as the sample she had just examined. Meaning that the guy in front of her not only worked fast, but did so without sacrificing quality. Granted, the gnome herself could easily do the same, but a total rookie pulling that off felt like cheating.
Show me how you put one of these together,
she demanded.
No.
Boxy didn't want to demonstrate it for her, since that would mean revealing it was a shapeshifter. If this truth got out, then it would no longer be able to stay in town and take advantage of the various goods and services that only civilization could provide. So if Fizzy were to somehow catch wind of it, she would have to be... dealt with. The persistent gnome, however, wouldn't give up so easily.
Come on! I'm super curious!
No.
Pretty please?
No.
I swear I won't spill your secret.
The mimic hesitated for a brief moment. If this little thing could keep it secret, then surely it would be okay. However, it then remembered Zira's helpful hint for blending into civilized society. Everybody lies.
No,
it repeated, though it did little to discourage the increasingly petulant gnome.
I have to know. I need to know.
She slammed her tiny fists onto the counter with more force than one would expect from a small woman like her. It actually shook the wooden counter, causing the blade blossom to rattle and clatter against its surface. There was the briefest moment of silence. before Fizzy and Boxy hit the deck as fast as they could. 40 tiny blades shot out from the steel rose-looking contraption in all directions. Some stuck into the ceiling, others into the wall. A couple cracked the window and a number of them hit the various metal bits and pieces strewn about the shop.
Ew!
Screamed Fizzy. One piece of shrapnel had ricocheted off something and stabbed her in the back of the arm, which started bleeding profusely.
Son of a bitch, that hurt!
The realization that there was another person in the shop dawned on her in the next instant.
Oh no. Boxy!
The thought that her carelessness might have killed or seriously injured someone sent her practically flying up to the counter to check on her customer.
Hey, are you... Oh... Kay?
The tiny gnome had lucked out and was only hit once, but her towering customer had not been as lucky. Boxy's massive stature had prevented it from ducking out of the way in time, causing it to get hit by two blades, one in the forehead and another in the eye. It casually stood and reached a pale hand up to the foreign objects, pulling them out without uttering so much as a peep.
"What are you?"
mumbled the dumbfounded gnome. That was when she noticed the viscous yellow blood oozing from the wounds. The gnome's already large eyes became the size of dinner plates. Even if she had never been in a fight, she still knew that only monsters had disgusting blood like that.
Gah!
She tried to call for help, but was silenced when Boxy lunged forward over the counter and put a hand over her mouth. The flesh of its palm and fingers swiftly reformed into an airtight gag that kept the gnome from mustering anything other than a muffled scream while also making it hard to breathe. She struggled, kicked and clawed at the monstrous appendage as tears welled up in her eyes, but she was unable to so much as budge her assailant's grip. The mimic climbed over the counter and got closer to its thrashing captive. A fleshy tendril shot out from under its cloak and picked up a length of rope that was nearby. This was quickly wrapped around the tiny prisoner, binding her hands and feet together. Fizzy watched in abject horror as her freedom was robbed from her. The monster in front of her produced some cloth scraps and lodged them in her mouth and throat, forming a less terrifying, though no less effective, gag. It then casually carried her into the back room, far away from any prying eyes. This room was about the size of the storefront and was, quite frankly, a mess. A tiny table had been turned into a workstation on the right, and a plethora of tools lined the wall around it. Numerous crates and boxes filled with various parts and pieces were strewn about haphazardly. A small hearth and anvil were in the far right corner of the room, the place where the shop's owner forged any custom parts she couldn't acquire for herself. A pile of iron, copper, bronze, and other common metal ingots lay next to it, and a rack with special alchemical solutions was hung up on the wall. The far left corner had a set of stairs leading up to the gnome's bedroom, and between it and the door were a line of cabinets stuffed with failed inventions, ruined prototypes, broken contraptions, and other random scrap.
Hey! Are you all right in here?
A ringing noise and a man's voice came from the storefront at almost the same time. It appeared someone had noticed the commotion and stepped inside to check. The ginger-haired young man saw the devastation caused by the blade blossom as well as what looked like bloodstains on the counter, but didn't see a person, living or otherwise.
Oh, merciful Teresa! He exclaimed. Hello? Is anyone hurt?
A pink-haired female gnome leaned out from behind the door in the back. Only her large head and upper body were visible.
Yes, hello!
She yelled back with an oddly chipper voice.
What happened here?
He asked, gesturing at the walls and ceiling.
Accident!
I see blood! Was anyone hurt?
Nothing serious.
The young man thought something was off about the gnome's tone of voice, and her attitude was a little bit suspect. She was way too happy, considering her shop was just wrecked. And that thumbs up she gave was a little too enthusiastic. There was also the weird sense of dread the young man felt when he looked into her large yellow eyes. He couldn't put his mind at ease, no matter how much he tried.
You sure you're not hurt? There's blood and... Is that mustard sauce?
I am fine. Drink healing potion.
I see. That's good to hear.
If the person herself